Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we will answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. On today's show, we have a special guest, Dr. Jonathan Volk, who's a primary care doctor and infectious disease specialist with a focus on PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, among those who are higher risk for HIV.
Please make sure to like us on Facebook, rate and review us on iTunes. It helps us get more eyes on our page and listeners, and tell your friends to check us out too. Thanks.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I am Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
Guys, I have a question for you. You ready? How are we doing?
Oh, we're really good. Should I ask you how we're doing?
You're asking me?
How are we?
Hey, who's on trial here? I asked the questions in the beginning. I'm doing okay, actually. I'm doing okay.
Even,
I'm on
even
call.
Even though you're on call, right.
I'm on call this weekend, and it's been an interesting weekend. Some, you know, part of the problem of call really, the patients are the best part of call. Sometimes it's the other things, like the interactions you have to have with other people that you work with. That can be difficult. That's really because, you know, everyone's stressed. People, there are late hours. People are working hard. Some people haven't gotten a lot of sleep. So it really tests your diplomacy.
Yeah.
And that's something we've talked about this before. Like when Lizzie said before, they should teach you and teach like these other like classes in medical school, like, you know, finance.
We don't do business. We need to learn how to, we talked about with Kevin MD, talk to a patient in a meaningful, connected way while typing on the computer so that you can, be efficient.
We also need to learn powers of diplomacy. And it's especially difficult when people are tired and stressed. And then doctors are pretty good about dealing with that stuff in general because we're kind of used to the stress, but at the same time, we could all use a refresher every now and then. I certainly every now and then need to stop myself and just be like, take a breath.
Yeah.
And then
smell the poop.
Right.
No, it's true that, you know, the patients are the least of the problem. It's a lot of times getting the patient to, for us, a procedure room. So it's not a transport person, but the system, right? And for me, I wasn't on call this weekend. But I had an obstacle. It wasn't a person. It was frozen poop.
Explain to our listening audience what you're talking about.
So there's something called fecal transplant or fecal microbiota transplant, FMT, which is a wonderful cure for C. diff colitis, Clostridium difficile colitis, which is a bacteria that causes really horrible colon infections and inflammation called colitis. And people sometimes are hospitalized and antibiotics work really well, but sometimes they don't. And there's this newish procedure. It's been being done for over a decade, but it's recently been becoming like a standard of care to give somebody donor poop into their colon to help cure the C. diff colitis. So I wasn't on call, but that procedure needed to get done. So I woke up really early because I have a freezer in my office with frozen poop.
Oh, she's bragging, huh?
Which makes me unique as a doctor.
Dr. Cool.
Right.
Dr. Cool, exactly. Dr. Frozen. So I woke up really early to get said frozen poop to help defrost it for a patient who needed it.
Is this similar to what Dr. Lowe had said with sharing people's stuff in their guts to...
It's along the same lines. Yeah, it's about changing the microbiome or the gut... the gut bacteria you have. And that is one way to do it rather dramatically, is to put someone else's poop into you.
And then how do they put it into you?
Excellent query.
It's a donor poop. It's been screened and evaluated. It's mass produced in a very sort of not sterile, because poop is not sterile.
It's not Lizzie.
Not
like
ingested,
in,
is
it's
it?
Not like Lizzie
not
in the back room. No, although I think when they first started doing this, they may have tried it through nasogastric tubes.
We do it. There's still, yeah. You can buy two versions. One is a higher volume, amount of poop that you use through a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy, or a worst case scenario, an enema, where you just flush it up there. And the other option is to do it through an NG tube, or use a camera from above and drop it into the stomach, or hopefully much beyond the stomach.
Right.
Called the small bowel that way. So yes, there's two different options. And
can you be out both of those, or are you conscious?
Yes.
The patient.
Well, it depends.
For the colonoscopy, the endoscopic procedures, you're going to get medication. You should be able to get medication unless there's something else going on with you that precludes that. You should be able to get sedation for those things.
If you're really sick and you
can't. Down the throat with the camera.
Well, the nasogastric tube where they put a tube down your nose, and that's sort of a, I actually haven't seen that, thankfully, but I do know what happened. So
yeah, I haven't done it. I did it once. I didn't participate. I mean, I don't put NG tubes down people's noses and into their esophagus, into their stomach anymore, because I'm a GI doctor, and that's really for the people on the teams on the floor, the medicine residents, the medicine attendings. Sometimes nurses do it, depends on where you are, but I don't. That's just not part of my day-to-day job anymore, really. I would if I needed to, but you can drop it that way, and you're wide awake. And if you're really sick and you can't get sedation or a procedure, the enema, the liquid from behind, from the bottom.
I was just going to say that. Rather have that than the down the mouth.
But the other one is the colonoscopy is the most effective. It's a not over 90% cure rate. It's really, you know, unfortunately, for the reaction on your face, unfortunately, it is the future.
So while you're talking about it, though, because actually people do ask these questions a lot, will you tell us a little bit about what it's indicated for currently?
So right now, and again, I actually don't think it's officially FDA approved, which is sort of interesting because poop can't be classified. It's not an organ. It's not a blood product. It's not a pharmaceutical agent. So honestly, this is why I have a freezer in my office with poop, because nobody will take it.
Wait, you're serious?
I'm completely. Oh, no.
She's
gonna post
totally
a picture.
Serious of this.
I'm going to post a picture on our website.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to post that.
I will. It's really, in San Francisco, space is an issue because we're in a city. Any city, you're going to fight over space. And because nobody will take it. Nobody will own it, except now, apparently,
the poop
me.
Queen. And to be clear, she's not like putting it in the same fridge like her sandwich is in. This is like a special
fridge.
Not
all the time.
It's a special fridge for this purpose, just for this purpose.
And beer will freeze and break the glass. So it's like a minus 20 degree.
So what are you using it for?
So again, it's the standard of care now. So local practice, this is what should be done. Again, even if it's not quite FDA approved, you need to just explain to the patient the risks and that it's going to be the kind of the most common practice in the future. It's indicated for people who have C. diff colitis, Clostridium difficile colitis, this infection, for people who've been on antibiotics and have failed. You know, this, you know, we two courses really of antibiotics, or people who get it again and have recurrent. So it's refractory C. diff or recurrent C. diff. And again, the cure rates for colonoscopy done, you introduce it into the colon, and even higher if you can, is like 95% cure. So it's amazing.
Are you getting patients asking you about using it for other purposes?
I have, and that's where it gets, you know, when something's not FDA approved and you're already doing something that's sort of quote unquote off label, mm-hmm. and then you're doing something that's like off label, because there's no great studies, but Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and even like irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. So IBD and IBS, which are terms that people confuse a lot, those are where the future studies are going, and people do ask about it. But at this time, it would be a very long conversation, and I would err towards sort of no, because we don't have robust data, because we do have great data for C. diff. You know, we don't have the other data. But so I'd have a very long conversation saying this, you might get a procedure, I might put foreign poop in your body, and it might not work.
When the people, I'm assuming by the time the people come to you, they're already kind of, they've been through a pretty bad infection. They've been through the ringer already. They're probably looking for anything and they're grateful, but are they pretty reluctant to do this? Are people still pretty grossed out by it? Are people ready for it? How are people dealing with this?
Just like anything, there's some people, first of all, sometimes you're on oral vancomycin, which is an antibiotic that works really well, and they're doing really well, but every time they stop the oral vancomycin, they have diarrhea and pain and symptoms related to C. diff. So some people are sort of fine. They're like, why can't I just be on Vanco forever? And then there is something that you'll read about in articles called, quote unquote, the ick factor. And that's a huge component to anything that we do. Even a colonoscopy. You've had patients who are like, I really don't want a camera up my poop chute. I had a patient recently tell me, things are meant to come out, not go up. I don't want that.
Well, I mean, I know a lot of people in the city that would disagree with him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so you just have a conversation and you tell people how effective it is and how it's, you know, we do it in a way that's not as icky as it sounds. So I'm not sure.
I think also it is becoming a little bit more common knowledge. People are starting to hear about it a little bit more. And I think it's probably gaining a little bit more acceptance is my read on it. I have people asking me about it for things that it's clearly not approved for yet.
Yeah.
And maybe it will be one day.
Is it human poop or what kind of poop?
It's usually duck poop. No, I'm just kidding. It's human poop.
They force feed the duck fatty meal. Like it's foie gras equivalent of poop.
No, it's human poop. It's like from a donor who's, I guess, got healthy poops and they screen it for disease.
Yeah.
How well you can screen poop, I don't know. And also, it's not like the poop, this is getting super gross. I'm sorry for the listeners. You might want to, if this is too gross, skip ahead 30 seconds.
The donor process, like.
But it's liquefied. It's not like they're putting straight pieces of poop into your butt. Like
it's like in a blender and it is frozen. And it does need to defrost, which is why I woke up super early.
Yeah, sometimes we do gross ourselves out, we're being honest.
The nurses, when we first started, were like, no way, I'm not doing that. And then, you know, if you ask them now, they're really, it's just, you know, the bottle connects to like the tubing. There's really no like exposure. So.
And we should add that it works. It's not like leeches. It's like actually there are some useful leeches,
like,
actually.
I've seen leeches.
But actually there is some benefit to this. So they actually, it justifies the ick factor because people feel better afterwards.
Yeah.
Sometimes for certain cases.
You can, I mean, you're almost, very few things in medicine are like 90, 95% cure. Like it's just, it's hard to fight with those numbers, you know?
That's right. You have to go with what works.
We're going to talk about an email that we got. I don't think you guys have read it yet. So I'm going to start.
I have not.
Well, here we go. Are you guys ready?
Let's do it.
Hi, Kaveh, Joe, and Lizzie.
I was first. Noted.
Okay. I love the show! ! So that's a pat on everyone's back. Mm-hmm. I've been a doctor for over 20 years, and I try to deliver good, fair, and consistent care. You've discussed how doctors' recommendations can be influenced by gifts from patients and from the pharmaceutical industry. But do you think doctors' recommendations or quality of care depends on the actual patient? In other words, do you think doctors play favorites and deliver better care or worse care to different patients? And if so, why?
Wow. That's a heavy one.
That's a heavy one for a doctor or a patient to answer.
Right. I mean, you certainly don't want to think that your doctor plays favorites unless you're the favorite.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, we talked a little bit about it with Dr. Binkley on ethics and just how, you know, we talked about with cookies, giving gifts and things like that. Do you, you know, and we don't generally accept gifts because we don't want at least to appear to play favorites. But I think this question from a seasoned doctor is sort of like, do we inherently have biases or favorites or.
Well, okay. You know. Here's what I will say. I will say this. I would say that the same way if you ask a parent, who's your favorite kid? And they're like, I love all my kids the same. Usually they're kind of full of crap. There's usually one that they're most proud of.
Right.
I think doctors also have favorite patients. They clearly have people they like better, they enjoy seeing. There's certain people they see on their schedule and they're like, oh, that person's coming in, great. Or I'm going to call this person. I know it's going to be a good call. I know that we're going to have a good conversation, even if it's going to be difficult news, even if it's going to be some difficult treatment options. I know that we're going to have a good conversation. So there's definitely favorites, but whether or not they get better care, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so because it's all that part of it, the treatment part of it is kind of, it's like muscle memory almost. You're going to go through the same process.
Right.
You're going to go through the same treatment algorithms. You're going to go through the whole thing. The only thing that might be better is if your communication with that person is better, you're going to be able to explain to them a little bit better about what's going on. That patient may have a better understanding of what's happening than, say, if the patient is someone you don't have good rapport with,
yeah,
then they're just not going to know as much about their disease process.
And this came up for me over the last year. I was talking about it with a friend of mine about how, you know, I was about to do a procedure on a patient who generally isn't doing well. And she said to me, you know, you're clearly like a great doctor. You know, I know that you're going to help me. I know that you're going to do a great job. I've been praying for you and this and that.
No pressure.
Yeah. And in this really sweet we barely knew each other. I met her sort of just for a procedure. This over the top way that, you know, felt like,
well, that's the New York in you where you're like, what is this person doing? Like, what are they?
I don't like it when people are nice to me. Right. No, right. This was,
like I go down the street. It's like, I'm in like a town that's not like the city. If I'm in a smaller town and someone on the street randomly smiles at me, I'm like, what?
Right.
What?
Yeah. No,
I want.
Yeah. Don't look at me. Anyway, she was talking to me in this way that made me feel like if she was so nice to me, over the top nice, I would do a better job. And it made me feel really uncomfortable. You know, just her kindness was very, I appreciated it. I was grateful, but I was like, do you think that I wouldn't take really good care of you if you were being mean to me? Because I think I would, you know? And that, it just made me feel a little uncomfortable. And I have a friend who works in the ICU whose patients go up to her and say, like, you know, this, my husband, he's really loved, so please take really good care of him. He's
So it's like when people have that baby on board in their backseat of their car. Right. You're like, okay, now I won't slam my car into yours.
Right. And the ironic thing about it is that somebody who's not really loved, who's, you know, homeless and it has no family members, they're the one who actually need more attention, time, effort. And it just, all these things just make me feel, it's almost as if they are handing me $100 bill and asking me to give their family member or themselves different care. And I don't, you know.
You know, I don't think that people get better care if they're nicer necessarily, but they're going to have a better experience if they are, I think. They're going to have a better experience with their doctor. And sorry, Joe, you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to say, I don't think it's a favoritism thing. I think what happens is, I think a doctor could get more pressured with certain types of patients than others. Like someone who does have a little bit of a medical background and they go in and see the doctor, they may have more questions and the doctor may be treating that patient differently than someone who's passive and doesn't know anything.
Right.
And I don't know if it affects the quality, but it definitely affects the whole interaction depending on the personality.
Yeah, it is. The really sweet people, I will tend to, hey, I'm so sorry to bother you, I have a quick question. I feel like I want to please them more by, like, in little things. Globally, I do think I treat people the same, but I will respond to that email a little bit quicker. Or somebody who's really, you know, I'm very unhappy with my care, this isn't a joke to me kind of email, I'll also reply to them quickly because they sound like they're going to, you know, sue me or something. Like, and then there's a whole, I think 80-90% of people are in between, but I do think that I reply, like, there's that family who's sort of over the top and aggressive, and you just feel like you have to respond very quickly. You feel on edge. It doesn't mean they're getting better care. Maybe they're getting worse care because you're feeling stressed out, but right. I will reply to them more quickly.
Well, the pressure thing you mentioned, that actually we've talked about this before. You know, patients sometimes when they want procedures, it's been shown that they're not actually benefiting from those things. If they're really pressuring for some treatment or some procedure or some surgery that the doctors may not really want, that doesn't necessarily do the patients well in the long run. So there might be the same sort of concept. If the relationship, it all comes, we talked about this a bunch. It's all about your communication with the doctor. You don't have to be super sweet to the doctor. You don't have to be phony or saccharine, and you don't have to do any of that. But, you know, having open communication with them, letting them know what you're thinking, what you want, that's always a good thing. I think doctors, we appreciate that. We want to hear what the patients have to say. We want to have that communication with them. And we want to have it in an honest way. That's probably the best way to do it.
The other thing it makes me think about is like in a referral-based practice where I'm trying to be really, really over the top nice. This isn't how I practice, but to patients so that they'll go back to their doctor. So they'll say, oh my God, Lizzie was so great. And that doctor will keep referring to me because we don't work like that. But when you are trying to generate a business, a livelihood, and grow your patient population, and you are looking for referrals, you actually have to sort of be over the top nice to your colleagues. And you know, it's word of mouth.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
When patients see me, they have no choice. Mwah,
Joe, what's your relationship like with your doctors?
Well, when you say my doctor, that's a good question because I've had several doctors.
Huh? What's your relationship with Kaveh? He's trying to ask you.
Do you like me?
You're my doctor now?
No.
Oh my God.
No, thank goodness. But like how do you feel? You feel like that you have a good rapport with them, and do you feel like that helps your medical care?
Tough question. I've had several different types of doctors, and when I was growing up, I had the doctor who was more personable, very friendly.
Your pediatrician, you mean?
Pediatrician, really good. Actually, when I had a different type of insurance, that's when things changed a little bit because I would go there and I would have different doctors every time I'd go in, and I never even knew their name. And this is many, many years ago. I think it's different now, but it was weird. I did not feel that connection, and I had a couple bad experiences with two different doctors because they were directly as a result of not listening to me. They gave me advice that was either wrong or incomplete, and I felt that it was because there was no relationship, and they were just punching the clock and moving me through. That's the feeling I had. Mm-hmm. And so no, I haven't had a good relationship with that type of environment of doctors, but the one I have now is pretty good. She's a private practice. I've only gone to her once, but
let me ask you, what is better about it? Is she, you feel like she's listening to you more, or you think she's giving you more time?
Well, the private practice doctors I've noticed have gotten to know me over the years, and there's that relationship. And in fact, one of the doctors I had me tested for the when you're producing too much
herpes.
Yeah, herpes. when you're producing too much iron, what is that called? And you have to like bleed out.
You have hemochromatosis.
My dad had that.
Really?
Yeah. And the doctor.
Are you sure?
If it's to say the thing that I'm talking about, yeah, iron level's too high.
So it's a very few thing in medicine that's like bloodletting is like right. It is the treatment, but that reminds me of like old school, the surgeon barber. We're going to bloodlet you.
For listeners, this is a problem where your gut absorbs too much iron, and when that happens, it's hard to lose iron. It sloughs off in skin and mucosa in certain ways, but the only way to lose a good amount of it is through basically phlebotomy or bloodletting. And if you don't, that iron accumulates in organs in your body it's not supposed to, like your liver or your heart, for example, and that can be really serious, and that can cause significant disease. So
No. So the doctor, knowing my dad, said, hey, Joe, we better test you for this gene that can cause whatever you just called. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. And sure enough, I have the gene. He didn't say I have the disease. There's no symptoms of it. It's something I have to watch. But being that he knew my father and had that relationship, I think it actually helped, because a normal doctor that's just seeing people all day is not going to catch something like that.
Well, here's what I would argue. Oh, actually, Lizzie, I don't know if you were about to say something, but this is my argument is that a good doctor in another system that doesn't know your dad is going to do a basic set of blood tests. And if you are having some issue from something like hemochromatosis, they'll be able to pick up something irregular on your testing and then work backwards from there to find out. And that's, I feel, you could argue, and I would argue, that's a better approach to the problem than saying, well, now you might have this gene, now what are you going to do with it? Because it's not really causing you any problems. Are you going to go get your blood tested all the time? What are you going to do with that bit of information that may or may not be useful to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole bag of worms about like genetic testing at all. Like if you knew you had like the BRCA gene, which Angelina Jolie made famous with high risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, when you're 18, do you want to know that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a lot of people argue yes, and that it's really useful. And a lot of people argue, no, you're 18. Like, you should live your life and not know about your incredibly high chance of cancer. You know, like...
Both Lizzie and I have experienced something where...
We are excellent doctors. We are.
Like, super good. Really, really, really good.
We experience that all the time.
But even us, like there will be a patient who's like, does not communicate well with me and will go to Lizzie. And there would be a patient of Lizzie's that doesn't communicate well with her and will want to come to me. Usually it's want to come to me. But, you know, And the point is that, like,
he clearly sends them to me just so that they go back to him, and they're like, "Oh my God, you are." I've seen the other side.
No, but it's just a communication thing, so it is important. We've talked about that before. It's finding someone who communicates in a way you like.
Anyway, that's a great email. Nobody gave a name, but I appreciate the email. We appreciate it. Please email us.
Yes, at hopquestions@gmail.com. That's hopquestions@gmail.com. Our phone number, if you want to call and leave either a good story about a foreign body or what we call a booty call, is 408-444-6623. That's 408-444.
Did you say foreign body?
Yeah, foreign body. Something that's not supposed to be in a body cavity that ends up in there.
Foreign
Where
in
have you
the
been
body.
The last 12 episodes?
I'm like Joey, talked about it like 18 times. I call it foreign body in orifice segment or something like that.
But I call it booty call.
But we decided booty call was better. Yeah.
If you call and leave us a good story, which we have a couple of those, and or if you have a question, also, you can leave a voicemail. Another thing.
No, 408.
408-444-6623. That's 408-444-6623. Joe, can you put a jingle to that?
Ding-a-ling.
Can you do a rap jingle to that?
Can you give me a beat?
Okay. I think that's wonderful. When we come back, we're going to have Jonathan Volk as our guest. He's a wonderful infectious disease and primary care doctor at Kaiser San Francisco and a lead author on important studies regarding PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, among high-risk patients for HIV.
And don't forget to review us, rate us on iTunes, and thanks for listening. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Let's start with the basics. For our listening audience who aren't doctors or haven't been treated for leishmaniasis in the past, what is an infectious disease doctor?
An infectious disease doctor is a physician that takes care of patients with diseases caused by viruses or bacteria or fungi or other organisms that can cause diseases in humans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. Joe, do you have any follow-ups for that? Joe's going to be the one, I think, taking lead on most of these questions because
he has a lot of questions about herpes. A
lot of herpes questions. I hope you're ready for some
I'm
herpes
ready for
questions.
The herpes question.
It's a theme of the show. So you do infectious disease, and you do primary care for mostly HIV positive patients.
That is correct. Yeah. So I take care of about 500 patients with HIV. So I treat their HIV, and I'm also their primary care physician. I am involved in the physician lead for our HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis program, our HIV prevention program.
Great. Or PrEP.
PrEP. Exactly.
Great. I think we're going to get back to that. But before we do, tell us, how did you get into infectious disease in the first place?
So when I was initially, I did my medicine training, so internal medicine training, and I always gravitated towards infectious diseases. I knew that's where my interest was. Personality wise, it just fits me.
That means you like chart review?
I do like chart review.
I'm just kidding.
A little detail oriented. I also, you know, infectious diseases is very few emergencies in infectious diseases.
Yeah.
It gives you time to actually think about things, to do a lot of research, to read, to make phone calls, right, to talk to colleagues. And
not coming in the middle of the night very much, I assume, right?
Not so often, no.
But you get called all the time, I assume.
Lots of phone calls, especially from the ED. Right.
There's no door to fungus time.
No door to fungus time.
So for cardiologists, Joe, we always say door to cath time, you know, to open up a heart vessel that's clogged. Yeah. And my joke for GI is there's no door to butt time. So now I've just added there's no door to fungus time.
There's no door to
it's
fungus
pretty good.
Time.
That's a good one. I'll give you that.
I have a t-shirt.
Yeah. We're going to start selling merch, and that's going to be one of them, I think.
Merchandise.
I think the other aspect that always interested me as well, especially with diseases like HIV, you're dealing with not only the medicine, but a lot of the social issues, the psychological issues, the interpersonal issues that come up with these diseases as well, that I think I've always found very interesting and challenging.
So yeah.
One thing I want to, so you're a primary care doctor for HIV positive patients, which suggests HIV positive patients need preventative care. And Kaveh and I were talking, and I feel like we're all the same age, that we are the ones who saw HIV AIDS become sort of this destructive, horrible thing where the regimen for medications was 3 times a day, 4 times a day, people's alarms are going off, to now current day is maybe one pill a day. and is a really what we consider now a chronic, manageable disease. Don't you find that like just incredible that we've seen that in our time? I'm sure that's an inspiration to you.
It's changed very quickly just during the last 10 years. So when I first started my medical training, exactly as you said, it was a very challenging disease. People were taking multiple medicines multiple times a day, having a lot of side effects from the medications. We were seeing a lot more opportunistic infections. So diseases that people are at risk for when they have HIV, to a disease now where for the vast majority of my patients are doing very well with once a day regimens, often one pill a day, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
That being said, we are still seeing patients that are coming in late with advanced HIV that are not getting diagnosed or not able to adhere or take the medications for a variety of reasons. So we are still seeing complications from HIV as well, even though we have great treatments available.
So screening is still incredibly important. The push to screen patients, all patients?
Screening patients who are at risk probably very regularly, and then most patients at least once. And then not only screening, once we diagnose patients, making sure that they're getting hooked into care, started on meds, and being able to keep them on medications once they start.
Mm-hmm. I got a question about the testing, the screening, and I agree it's so important, but I feel like there's not enough emphasis. I don't know if it's in the media or awareness, but there's now, I'm being told, screening options where you can take a 10-minute HIV test with like a swab. You can even buy the ones that you can do on your own. Are those, in your opinion, reliable or accurate? And if so, do you know why they're not sort of pushed more? Or because I think a lot of people are afraid to get the test because of waiting a few days and going through the agony of worrying about it, but a 10-minute test would eliminate a lot of that.
So there are home tests available now that you can buy at stores yourself. You don't need a doctor's order or prescription.
You can get the pregnancy test and the HIV test next
exactly.
to each other.
Yeah, exactly. And the tests are actually quite good. Some of the challenges with the home testing is they might not pick up infections quite as quickly as some of the tests that we have available, such as a test that looks for the virus itself can pick up infections after about 10 to 14 days.
So they're antibody viruses or antibody tests, the home ones, the home.
Exactly. Yeah. And some of the tests, the window period, so the period between when someone's infected and when we can detect it with the test might be a little bit longer
Got
with
it.
The home tests, but they are quite good.
Do you still recommend, I remember in training, there used to be like, you have to check twice. If you thought you were exposed, you had to check like in 3 months after the exposure, 6 months. Are the tests good enough now where you don't have to do that?
It depends on which test you're using and when the exposure was. So certainly our best test as far as being able to pick up infections is an HIV viral load, which is a test that looks for the virus itself. Mm-hmm. And most people will be able to test that and it will show up as positive within about 2 weeks of exposure. Mm. So if you do a viral load and say someone's in risk for HIV was a month ago, I would feel very good that we would
have picked
it up.
You feel confident about that.
Yes.
I didn't realize you could do the home testing. Like that must have been such a controversial conversation. Like, do we want people to be at home without any sort of
medical,
social, emotional support and find out you have HIV? I mean, clearly you're going to go pick up the test because you think you have had an exposure. So maybe you're already mentally prepared, but were you like...
That's a really good question because I remember like when we first... We're testing for it in our training. It was a big deal.
You needed consent
to check them for it. You needed to go through a whole process to tell them about it. So it does seem strange to me that now you could just pick it up like as you pick up like your pregnancy test, like you
said.
What we really want to do, though, is reduce barriers to people getting tested. And we were finding that having people come in for pre-test counseling and then coming back later and then doing post-test counseling, it's a lot of steps that people had to go through to get these tests and people weren't getting tested.
And it probably contributes to like the stigma. You know, the more labor involved and the more hurdles to get tested and the more consents and the more conversations, it makes you feel different than just a regular hep B test.
I think you're bringing up a very important point, which is this idea of kind of HIV exceptionalism, that we were treating HIV very differently than we were all these other infections that we treat. And I think making these tests more available and trying to reduce those barriers to testing does help to reduce some of the stigma. And these home tests were very well studied. So they did a lot of testing to kind of see how people responded, see what the needs were for individuals.
Right.
And so there was a lot of thought that went into this before they started making these home tests readily available.
Yeah, and another added benefit I think that's really important too is the privacy. That's the huge factor for driving sales of those tests, I would think.
One of the interesting studies they did with the home tests is they gave men who have sex with men who are at high risk for HIV home tests, and men tested for HIV with their sexual partners before having sex. And then they found out, you know, how often they were using it, how things went if people tested positive prior to those sexual encounters. And several of the times people did test positive, and it was ended up being a positive experience. People did not end up having sex when that happened, but people were linked to care.
Wow. So along those lines, and you kind of mentioned it already, but has the stigma really changed? Is there still kind of a stigma about HIV? Is it changed in a significant way?
I think we're making headway, but I think definitely stigma definitely exists. We're making improvements, but it certainly, you know, I think we're a little bit different maybe in San Francisco. I think there's a very large vocal and politically active HIV positive community here in San Francisco, but I think certainly other parts of the country that may not be the case. I know we're going to talk a little bit more about PrEP as well, but I think PrEP has also been an important piece that's helped to reduce stigma about HIV as well.
Right. We can go into that. So we just say PrEP stands for
pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Okay. And a couple of years ago, you were the lead author in a study from the the Journal of Clinical Infectious Disease, studying, you can tell more about it and how effective PrEP was. And I guess, you know, the pros and cons, because I certainly have patients on it and I'll see like Truvada, no plug, on their list. And I have to take a second look, because I'll see that medication throughout the years and I'll think, oh, they're HIV positive. But now I have to actually really look into the chart more carefully, because now I know it might be PrEP.
Exactly.
So it's interesting.
So what PrEP is the idea of PrEP is that people can take a medication before exposure to HIV occurs to prevent acquisition or infection with HIV. The only medicine that's approved right now, FDA approved in the United States, is a medicine called Truvada, as you mentioned, and it's recommended to take daily before an exposure occurs, and we found that it's been incredibly effective. So in the last handful of years, there's been several large randomized controlled trials in men who have sex with men and transgender women and women and serodiscordant couples. So that's couples where one partner has HIV and one partner is HIV negative, and in injection drug users. And what we found from those studies is that PrEP, when taken daily, significantly reduces risk for HIV. The study that you were referencing, we had a lot of data from randomized control trials, but we didn't have a lot of data from real-world clinical experience with PrEP. And with many things in medicine, we find when we move from randomized control trials to clinical practice, things actually work less well in the real world, because you don't have all of the structure and support that it comes with these randomized control trials. And what was really striking about our experience at Kaiser San Francisco with pre-exposure prophylaxis is that we found that this medicine worked even better than we expected. And we had no new infections with hundreds of persons of years of follow-up. Right now, we actually just recently published some more data that shows we have over 5,000 patients throughout Kaiser Northern California on pre-exposure prophylaxis, 2,000 here in San Francisco, or about 2,000. And we've had no new HIV infections among people who are using the medication.
Wow, very cool, man.
That is incredible.
And not to understate how important I think that study is, I think that makes a pretty big difference in a lot of people's lives. So that's pretty great.
It's huge. I mean, to me, it's as close as a vaccine as you could get, you know, and... Man, I guess the obvious question is, why not have everybody go on PrEP? Is there bad side effects, or is there dangerous drugs to take, or what's your take on that?
Well, certainly, you know, we're learning more about, you know, you're getting at kind of pros and cons of the medicine. Certainly, for most of the patients that I see that are at risk for HIV, the benefits of the medication usually outweigh the potential side effects or risks. The things that we think about when we're prescribing the medicine, the most common side effect that we see is some stomach upset. So some diarrhea, some bloating, some gassiness, usually just the first couple of weeks that people are using the medicine. And most people do get used to that pretty quickly. And it's unusual for people to stop because of those side effects. Mm-hmm. We do need to monitor kidney function. However, as long as we're monitoring kidney function and stop the medication, if we see some worsening in kidney function, we have not seen any irreversible kidney problems with this medication, nor has anybody else that I'm aware of.
Is that a cumulative risk of taking the medication, or is it one time you take it, you're at risk for kidney problems?
So certainly, sometimes we can see it early after starting the medication, or it can happen after even several years of the medication. So it does require ongoing follow-up. What we found is that the patients who are at highest risk for that are people who are older, so patients who are over 50 years old, or patients who have slightly abnormal kidney function at baseline is where we're seeing the majority of our issues. But we're talking about 1 or 2% at most, so this is a small number. And as long as we're doing that lab follow-up and stop the medication, we have not run into any problems with irreversible kidney function damage.
Yeah, and then just other kind of consequences of taking PrEP daily for months or years at a time obviously would be risks of other sexually transmitted diseases that you're not accounting for. So what are the ones that I guess you see in your practice, or I'm not up to date on all the literature, what you see in your studies?
Yeah. So, you know, I tell a lot of my patients, HIV has friends and we're seeing a lot of them.
Yeah. We've seen some more acute hep C, and that's part of one of the things you studied as well. But in GI, we're also liver doctors, hepatology, so we see hep B, hep C as well. So
exactly, yeah. As an infectious disease job doctor, it's job security I'd rather not have.
Right.
So we are seeing a lot of STDs. So the most common that we're seeing actually is rectal chlamydia. But we're seeing a lot of chlamydia infections, a lot of gonorrhea, a fair bit of syphilis, and then we've also had a handful of acute hepatitis C infections as well among our PrEP patients. So when we look at our data, we're seeing about half of our patients on PrEP with at least one STD every year. We do not have a control group, so we don't know how many STDs we would have seen without PrEP. So it's possible that we would have seen these STDs even if patients were not taking the medication. One thing that I think is really important to emphasize, though, is that PrEP is designed to prevent HIV infection. It's not designed for hepatitis C or syphilis or gonorrhea or chlamydia. Right. The fact that we're seeing so many STDs, the fact that we found that some of our patients, so a substantial minority of our patients, do report some decreases in condom use. So despite the fact that we're seeing a lot of STDs and some decrease in condom use, we're still not seeing any HIV infections.
Yeah.
So what it really emphasizes how well this medication works.
Right. And all those other diseases are, you know, nobody wants them, but they're treatable. And I mean, the argument against PrEP would be decreased condom use and therefore more spread of other diseases. Right. But you could argue that these people weren't going to use condoms anyway.
I would rather treat someone 10 times for chlamydia than once for HIV.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, those are all curable diseases, theoretically, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important for us to make sure we're having those conversations with patients. Certainly, we can see complications with syphilis. Resistance with gonorrhea is something that we've been thinking about and aware of kind of globally for many years. And then, of course, hepatitis C is a challenge when it does occur. And so we do talk to patients about the fact that there still is a role for condoms, especially in prevention of those other sexually transmitted infections that we're seeing. I should also mention, if you look at some of the trends in STDs in places like San Francisco and around the country, we were seeing increases in STDs that predate the really widespread use of PrEP. And so I think PrEP sometimes gets blamed for these increases in STDs, and I don't think that's fair. I think we were seeing an increase in STDs that predates that as well.
Yeah, because PrEP has been around or approved for, I know your study was 2.5 years ago or so, but when was it actually approved?
It was FDA approved in July of 2012.
Okay.
So about 5 years now.
Yeah.
Do you think this PrEP is a breakthrough in science, in the sense that it not only, I know that it only works for HIV now, but conceptually could antivirals or whatever PrEP is based on be used in treating other diseases in the future, in your opinion?
It's an interesting question. You know, certainly with bacteria, the challenges with the idea of, with prophylaxis is that bacteria can develop resistance. And so the concern is that could you develop resistance or after time these medications stop working? And that's always a concern. We do use bacterial prophylaxis for other indications as well. For example, patients with cirrhosis.
Do you feel like people are testing more for STDs now because of this? And if they aren't, should they be?
That's a great point. So certainly when our patients are on PrEP, we're doing follow-up very regularly. The fact that we're seeing as many STDs as we are, SDIs as we are, sexually transmitted infections, really emphasizes that testing for sexually transmitted infections needs to be an important part of any PrEP program.
Right.
Because we want to diagnose these infections early and treat them early if we can. And the vast majority of these infections, especially infections in the throat or the rectum, are actually without symptoms. Mm. And so unless we're actively screening, we're going to miss most of those.
Yeah. And then as far as PrEP for women, I do think it was recently, I'd emailed you, approved by the New York City Department of Health, at least, to use in women who are maybe, again, at higher risk. You always have to sort of select out populations, right? Which is probably part of the hardest thing to do. We don't want everybody in the world on Truvada every day, but we have to figure out which populations are the highest risk.
It's a great point. So in San Francisco, the majority of our patients who are using PrEP are men who have sex with men. And that's somewhat largely reflecting our epidemic here in San Francisco and what we see as far as who's at risk. But if you look globally, it's actually women who are at highest risk for HIV infection. There's been several large studies now looking at PrEP in women, and I think the data is really compelling that this is a very valuable intervention.
Yeah.
The challenge is identifying women who may be at high risk for HIV, and that can be sometimes tricky to do.
Yeah.
Adherence to the medication is really the critical to how well this drug works, and I think that's especially true for women. We have very good data for men, at least, or men who have sex with men, that adherence doesn't need to be perfect to get very high levels of protection. People who are using the medication, even if they're missing a couple days a week, are still going to be very much protected from HIV. Mm-hmm. There's less forgiveness for the medicine, probably, for women. The drug does not concentrate as well in vaginal tissue as it does in rectal tissue.
Oh, interesting.
And so adherence is going to be really critical for women who are using PrEP. But certainly, for women who are at high risk for HIV, I think PrEP is a really important intervention for us to be thinking about.
So along that with, if you miss a dose, then you're talking about an exposure, and that goes with something Joe was bringing up earlier, was post-exposure prophylaxis, right? Do you call it PEP? Because it sounds sort of funny.
PEP, yeah, and it gets confusing with PrEP and PEP because they sound very similar. I should say, just to your last point, if people miss a dose occasionally, as long as they've been taking it pretty regularly, they're going to have high levels of protection. So I don't worry too much. Adherence does not need to be perfect. Mm-hmm. In fact, in one of the studies, they found that people, men at least, who had drug levels consistent with 4 times a week dosing, they did not see any new infections. Hmm. Not that I would be recommending it right. 4 times a week, but that if people are missing doses occasionally, I'm feeling pretty confident that they would be largely protected. PEP is really a very powerful intervention as well. So that's post-exposure prophylaxis as opposed to pre-exposure prophylaxis. You can kind of think of it analogous to, say, the birth control pill and the morning after pill.
Yeah.
Except for in this case, for a long time, we were using the same medicine for PEP as opposed to and PrEP. So it's a little tricky.
And also in this case, no baby in the end, right?
No baby in the
okay.
end.
Okay.
No, yeah.
Got it.
In most situations, not always.
That's true.
So with post-exposure prophylaxis, the idea is if someone is exposed or potentially exposed to HIV, they can take a medicine for 28 days after that exposure to reduce risk for HIV infection.
And we've seen that, right, with our own colleagues and peers in residency. If you got a finger stick with a needle, specifically a large large bore needle, you know, I've had peers who've taken post-exposure prophylaxis. That's been around for a while.
I should have mentioned that's one of the other reasons I went into infectious diseases is there's no procedures. And
I thought you were going to say you got a needle stick.
I had 3 needle sticks during my internship.
And so you were like, this is not for me. This is not my thing.
Yeah.
I have a tremor, so no one who nears me, no one who loves me would let me go near them with anything sharp.
that's good to know about yourself.
That narrows down my specialty options.
Yeah. Right.
So post-exposure, it needs to be taken within 3 days of an exposure, but 2 days is better than 3, and a day is probably better than 2 days, and an hour is probably better than a day. And, you know, for a long time, we were using, starting in the mid-late 80s, actually, we were using AZT, which was our first drug approved for HIV for post-exposure prophylaxis. So this is an intervention that's been around for 30 years. The drugs that we've used for post-exposure have changed as we've had more medications available. For many years, we were using Truvada as one of our first lines for post-exposure, the same drug we use for PrEP. Now, most people are using Truvada with the addition of a third drug for post-exposure prophylaxis. PEP works really well when there's clearly identifiable exposures. For example, a physician who has a needle stick in the hospital, like what happened to me as an intern, or a patient who tells me, I always use condoms, but I'm worried the condom might break. The condom breaks, they know they may have been exposed to HIV, and they can come in and take post-exposure prophylaxis for 28 days. The problem is for many patients, people will have ongoing exposures. And so then you're taking PEP and you're taking PEP and you're taking PEP, and then PrEP makes a lot more sense in that situation. Or people may not realize when they've been exposed. I saw a young patient who had what he thought was a very high risk exposure and came in for post-exposure prophylaxis. He had also had sex without a condom several other times in the last few months with people that he knew really well and didn't realize that he had already been infected with HIV from one of those other sexual encounters. And so for people who may not realize when exposures may happen or may have regular exposures, then PrEP makes a lot more sense than PEP. But certainly it's nice to have more options. And so when patients come in to see me for PrEP, not everybody that we see for PrEP decides to start on the medications. Some people may decide that PEP makes more sense for them, or that if they are using condoms 100% of the time, maybe that's a reasonable option for them. And so we have lots of tools now. And when we see patients for PrEP, it's really an individualized discussion about risks and benefits of these medicine and what makes sense for them.
And how important do you think it is? I'm sure for you it is, but just like sexual lifestyle, sexual behavior, you know, as a med student, nobody really sits down and talks to you about stuff like that. It's sort of an on the job kind of training thing. I do remember a pathologist who was giving us this really intense lecture about cellular activity, you know, stopped at the end. And he's like, I want to leave the last 15 minutes of this lecture and talk to you guys about talking to your patients about their sexual behavior. You have to ask, you know, these questions very directly, not just, are you active? That kind of thing. Like, you know, how important is it to you in your practice? And where do you learn that? Like, you know, it takes tact. It takes a delicate hand, if you will, you know?
I think that's a really important point. It does take practice, and eventually you learn language that feels comfortable to you and to the patients that you're talking to. I found that a lot of patients actually really enjoy it. They come in for a visit with myself or one of my colleagues who's also seeing patients for PrEP, and it's often the first time that people are asking them about, you know, who they're having sex with and what kind of sex they enjoy, right. What their concerns are about STDs, and really having that open dialogue. I think I've also developed a fair bit of humility. You know, certainly when you're first learning how to have these conversations, people might tell you things that you've never heard of or you don't know anything about, and you ask.
Right.
And I think patients enjoy teaching us as well.
We've heard some terms that we didn't know before working in the Bay Area.
Serosorting.
Power bottoming.
Yeah, those are two terms that I learned in the last few years.
I could add a few, but probably sure. For this conversation.
It's a family show, yeah. John.
G-rated.
I have to say, I, when that happens, it doesn't happen very much anymore. Having had these conversations a lot, but when it does, I get very excited. I get to learn something new today.
But actually,
look on UrbanDictionary.com.
But it's important to note, like you said, we live in this particular place where it's much more open to that sort of discussion. I think it's even harder for doctors, say, in other parts of the country where there isn't a large openly vocal gay population, to ask them questions about like receiving anal sex, receptive anal sex, and getting questions that are important. And for a gastroenterologist, it is important sometimes, you know, when we're taking a look, sometimes we need to know. And there is a certain level of discomfort that a lot of doctors have with that. It's something that we all need to sort of address.
And I think it's just the general discomfort talking about sex in general that I think a lot of us have trouble talking about it. I think just the more you do it and the more comfortable you are.
The more sex you have or the more you talk about it?
Perhaps both.
But I actually was thinking the same thing, Lizzie.
Yeah, the more you talk about it, you know, I don't know if you necessarily need to be having lots of sex yourself to be able to talk to patients about it. But patients can tell when you're not comfortable having those conversations.
Right.
And I think especially when you're talking about things like hepatitis C, it becomes really important to be able to ask patients about injection drug use, to be asking patients about types of sex that can cause more rectal bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the infections that we've seen with hepatitis C. These are patients that are engaging in activities that might involve more rectal trauma. For example, sex with someone with a penile piercing or a group sex. And those are not necessarily questions that doctors are usually asking their patients, but right. I find that when I bring these topics up, patients are actually really interested to learn about it.
That's good to know, because I think a lot of times we're nervous to ask just because we don't know if the patient wants to talk about it and if the patient wants to bring it up. And so we get scared about that too.
Yeah.
John, thank you so much for coming in. That was really useful. We learned a ton.
Yeah, it
was thank
great.
You. Thanks really for all the work insightful. You've been doing with this too. And
Send us your any updated articles. You know, we get them. We get the emails through Kaiser because everyone's so proud. And really, they're wonderful. Totally like cutting edge. You know, future, the future of medicine. It's awesome.
You know, it's really been a game changer. You know, I think we were talking about it. We started the conversation by talking about why I went into infectious diseases, and my understanding when I started this career path was that I'd be treating infectious diseases. I didn't realize that I'd be spending so much of my time trying to prevent infectious diseases in the first place.
Even
so that's
better,
really been
right?
Much better. So that's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for all the emails, and please keep them coming. hopquestions@gmail.com. Please call us as well and leave a voicemail 408-444-6623. Thanks for listening.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.